On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Grandmaster Garry Kasparov was the youngest world chess champ ever at 22 when he took the title in 1985. He held it for 15 years, the longest reign in history, lost to IBM's Deep Blue, then fought back to beat the supercomputer, retired to Moscow with the highest chess rating ever. Now Garry Kasparov has taken his game to the streets as a high-profile political dissident and is up against Vladimir Putin at a time when Russia is cracking down on dissent. This is a dangerous game. Up next on Point, chess master Garry Kasparov on dissent and Russia now. Joining me now from New York, where he's just flown in, is Garry Kasparov. In 2005, he retired from professional chess and announced his intention to challenge Vladimir Putin for Russian leadership. Garry Kasparov, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So, broad stroke, what is a former chess champ doing in the middle of Russian politics? What's put you there?
It's my country, and I believe my country is in trouble. I have been defending the colors of my country for 25 years, and I believe now I'm doing the same. I think the country is on the wrong path. For 7 years, Putin and his cronies have been steadily destroying democratic institutions in Russia, and we have to restore that as soon as possible. Otherwise, the country will be in jeopardy.
You got arrested last month in the streets, in Pushkin Square in Moscow, in protests where thousands of riot police came out with truncheons and all the rest. Same day in St. Petersburg, people beaten. What happened?
In fact, I was arrested before demonstration even began. I was arrested about 50 yards from Pushkin Square, it was all illegal. And many protesters were arrested before and during the demonstration. Next day, many arrested and severely beaten in St. Petersburg. And now, according to Russian human rights groups, there's only one extremist on the Russian streets. It's the Russian government, because police is violating every article of Russian constitution and all the laws of the land.
You yourself were held late into the night by the successor to the KGB. How did they treat you? What did they want to know from you? What did they have to say to you when you were in detention?
It was about 11 hours. They held me in custody. It was police, and then they brought me to the courtroom. I was charged for violating public order. The exact charge was Garry Kasparov in the big crowd was walking down the Tversky Street. This is the big street in the center of Moscow, chanting anti-government slogans. Mm. But the problem for the court was that the police officer who testified against me, he had the wrong time of my arrest, 1:30 p.m., while the whole world could see that I was arrested at 12:05. He also misnamed the location, and he couldn't recall any circumstances of the police action against our group. But eventually, the judge decided that the testimony of the police officer was credible because, now that's important, that's a part of the verdict, because the man was on duty. That's a fundamental discovery of Putin's judiciary, because now anybody can be accused on the testimony of the police officer because the man is simply wearing the uniform. Mm. And then I was released with the fine of 1,000 rubles. It's about $40. But most important, now I have a record. So next time they could put me behind bars for 15 days.
How do you see what's going on right now? Vladimir Putin recently said that despite speculation to the contrary, he's not going to try to go for a third term to change the law and do that. He said, you know, the man who reports on the state of the nation next year will not be him in 2008. At the same time, you've said that he has built one of the world's most notorious dictatorships. You're quoted recently saying of Russia, "We now stand somewhere between Belarus and Zimbabwe." Give us a sense of where you see Russia having come and why.
Yeah, I think technically speaking, if we analyze the current Russian laws, the laws on extremism, and also the application of these laws to the political dissidents, yes, Russia is somewhere between Belarus and Zimbabwe. And it does not contradict Putin's intention to leave his office in March 2008 because the Russian regime, the Putin's regime, now is facing some of the odd paradoxes. The first one is that they don't want to be influenced in one way or another by the Western democracies. But at the same time, the entire fortune of a Russian elite is kept in the countries where the law and order are respected. So breaking up all the relations with the West, it's not an option, because then these hundreds of billions of dollars allocated in France, Spain, Italy, Switzerland, the United Kingdom, all this money, all these fortunes could be in danger. So I think that Putin doesn't want even to give a remote chance for him and his allies to be treated as Lukashenko or Mugabe. At the same time, they know that if Putin goes and leaves a vacuum behind him, then the fight between different Kremlin groups will intensify, and this fight can also jeopardize this very fragile stability, political stability in Russia, because according to the gang rule, the winner of such a battle will have to eliminate all his opponents. So that's why Putin have to walk just between these two potential evils, and his latest statements demonstrating that he doesn't know what kind of policy, what kind of behavior he should project to calm down Russian bureaucracy. Also, he's facing personally another paradox. If he wants guarantees that will be reliable, that nothing happens with him when he leaves his office, he needs a weak successor. If he wants the system to survive, he needs a strong successor. And I think being struck with all these paradoxes, Putin transmits all these contradictory messages to the rest of the world. Mm.
And what about you in the midst of all of this? When you retired from chess in 2005, you wrote in the Wall Street Journal, where your essays appear with some regularity, said, "I'm a man who needs a goal, who needs to make a difference, a man with big ambitions, who's always played chess aggressively." You said there, "My retirement is not about running for president or any other high office," but you weren't ruling it out at the same time. And in that same season in 2005, you were named as one of the Russians or people in Russia vying to succeed Vladimir Putin. Are you in that game? Do you picture yourself next year or in the future as a potential leader of Russia?
We are not yet fighting to win elections. We're fighting to have an election. And this is a very different fight, because here, for instance, in this country, you know that in November 2008, there will be an election and the George W. Bush will not run. And, you know, all the legalities that will be respected throughout the whole process, from primaries to the final day of the vote. While in Russia, we are not yet sure even that the official date of the election will be held. We're still talking as today with you whether Putin is going to stay or he's going to leave his office. There are many rumors about potential successors. There are also rumors about Putin stepping down early as Yeltsin, handpicking his successor. There are many, many options that are showing that Russian political life, you know, is yet to be fixed. And our goal, the goal of the coalition, the Other Russia, where I'm playing a role of coordinator, is to make sure that we restore normal democratic process which leads to free and fair elections. And I believe that I have to stay as a coordinator for a time being, because otherwise this very fragile coalition that includes forces from right to the left, liberals and conservatives, those who believe that restoration of democratic process is a top priority, this coalition may fall.
I promise you, we'll look more closely at that, the threat to democracy there, how Putin's running the country, his popularity and so on. But I just want to understand, if it's possible, how you see yourself eventually in this. If democracy returns, I mean, you're not a stranger to politics, even though you were playing chess for a long time. You were elected to the Central Committee of the Komsomol, you know, way back when.
Yeah, it was not. At that time, there was no elections. It's just an appointment.
Okay, appointed, but I mean,
Of the Soviet chess world champion.
Right, but you've had your oar in there. In Russia, a chess player, an intellectual, may have a different status than in the United States, a higher status. Do you see yourself as a potential leader of the nation of Russia?
Such hypothetical possibilities far ahead. So now, as a professional player, I have to concentrate on our immediate goal for next 10 months before officially announced presidential elections in March 2008. Mm-hmm. And I believe that I have to do my utmost to make sure that our coalition wins or our chances to win are improved. And I will do whatever it takes. But for the immediate future, I think that I'll stay as the coordinator of the efforts of the different opposition groups.
That's not a yes, but it's not a no. There's so much we want to hear from you. We're delighted to have you. You know the chessboard well. Is this a game you can possibly win, Garry Kasparov?
Why not? If it's a game, you always have a chance of winning if you understand the rules. And the only rule in Russian politics, there are no rules, because Kremlin changes rules at any time upon their convenience. But at the same time, they're also acting in accordance with their interests. And if you can calculate this interest, and if you could see that this elite is not as united as they want to pretend, you can always find some sort of a strategy to improve your winning chances.
Garry Kasparov, listen with me for just a moment, if you would, to Russian President Vladimir Putin speaking on state television about the death of former President Boris Yeltsin.
Умер Борис Николаевич Ельцин, первый президент России.
Boris Yeltsin has died, the first president of Russia. With this, he became a part of history, both for our country and the whole world. The man has passed away who started the whole era. A new democratic Russia was born, free and open to the world. The state where people do have power.
The state where people do have power, a new democratic Russia born free and open to the world. Mr. Kasparov, what do you make of the way Vladimir Putin, in his rhetoric, in his eulogy, used the moment of Yeltsin's death to try and frame what Russia is as he would like it to be seen?
I'm not sure that it's what he likes Russia to be seen, because next day, on April 26, next day after the funeral, Putin delivered his State of the Union to Russian Parliament, and it was a totally different message. He was blaming the West and some radical extremist forces in trying to destroy stability in Russia, and the word democracy was used in a very disgusting context.
Disgusted, I guess. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes, and he was talking about the 90s as the disastrous years in Russian history. I believe that the Putin speech at the Yeltsin's funeral was his attempt to preserve the memory, not of Yeltsin or his democratic legacy, but the first president of Russia, because Putin has to solve his personal problem of keeping himself as the untouchable of Russian politics. So that's why he has one personal interest of making Yeltsin as the president also some sort of a saint in Russian politics.
Give us a sense, if you would, put on your chess master hat, and for those of us who aren't there and don't know it nearly as intimately as you, if you look at Russia today as a chessboard for a moment, how do you see the major players? What are the interests that are producing the Russia that we see? Give us the Kasparov kind of analysis of the chessboard of Russian power and politics today. How would you lay it out?
First of all, I would like to say that Russia today is divided into uneven parts. There are two countries. One is probably 15%, approximately 20 million people, and that's the country that you can see on the Western television. That's a country that is being trumpeted by Kremlin propaganda. Mm. That's a country with luxurious shops, boutiques, restaurants, yachts, oligarchs, upper middle class, high consumer confidence index, and many other good things. Mm. On the other side of the fence, you have 120 million Russians, 85%. Mm-hmm. And this country is very different. And this country has very little to hope for. This country expected Putin to create a miracle and to improve their conditions, but they didn't see much, if anything. There were a few years of stability in the beginning of Putin's first term when the oil prices went up and there was some sort of fair distribution of the national wealth. But now the gap between rich and poor is growing, and the latest numbers showing that the combined wealth of 100 richest Russians is one-third more than the entire annual revenue of Russian budget. Mm. That's unseen even for African countries now. And also, we are having the growing discontent even among this 15%, because they recognize that this regime is offering no future for the country. I wouldn't say that Putin even runs the country as a president. It's more like a CEO who is running the corporation Russia. And we joke in Russia that all expenses in our country are nationalized while all the profits are privatized. Mm. And of course, for a CEO of the corporation, social expenses will be liabilities. Mm. So that's why Putin's regime is cutting on those expenses that they believe are not helping these VIP shareholders.
So there's a great kind of X-ray of the population by Garry Kasparov. But what about the power within that? Who's pulling the strings here? Is it? I mean, we've seen some very big businessmen in oil and elsewhere thrown in jail. There are obviously oligarchs, but are they the power? Is it the Putin sort of rump of the KGB? Is it the police? Who's really running things? Where does the power lie in Russia now?
I think that's the power is vanishing in Russia quite quickly, because the only legacy that is kept is Putin's election. Also, in my view, it was a forged election in 2004. But still, you know, people believe that Putin as a president carried some sort of authority, while all other institutions have no respect whatsoever in all the quarters of Russia. It's very difficult to make any projections of current situation in Russia into the normal democratic environment in the United States or in Europe, because the political system that was formed under Yeltsin was not also fully democratic. Yeltsin owed his power to the street, and he couldn't cut the ties with democratic institutions. Mm. That's why under Yeltsin, the two systems coexisted alongside each other. On one side, democracy, democratic institutions. On other side, some sort of the Byzantine palace intrigue, his nomenclatura rule. Mm. And no doubt that Yeltsin's successor had to choose one or another. And picking up KGB Lieutenant Colonel, Yeltsin made his choice. And, of course, Putin followed these instructions of Russian ruling elite and destroyed anything that was threatening the unlimited, unchecked rules of Russian bureaucracy.
So now the heart of power now then, is it with the apparatchiks, the former KGB, the police, or is it with the oligarchs, or are they the same thing? Is it an alliance?
Absolutely. It's the same thing, because the oligarchs today in Russia, they are state officials. All the top Kremlin officials, they are running the major so-called nationalized corporations. But the nationalization under Putin, it was another fake, because all the money goes abroad under the control of these top Kremlin guys that are conducting these financial channels one way or another. So I don't think Aristotle could find a better definition of oligarchy as exists today in Russia.
The longest reigning world chess champ in history, Garry Kasparov, is with us. He's been in the streets. He's been arrested just in the last couple of weeks for his dissidence in Russia today. Garry Kasparov, a lot of listeners want to join us. Let me begin to invite them in. Michael is calling from Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Michael, you're on the air with Garry Kasparov.
Hello, gentlemen. It's an honor to speak to you.
Good to have you. What do you know?
Well, for the past few years now, I've been helping a lot of the young Russian students come over to America for job programs.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them, or most of them, don't want to go home. So they're fearing their future in their country, and they're doing everything they possibly can legally to stay here. And their question to your guest is, should they go home and fight for their freedom, or should they stay and live in a country that believes live free or die?
Garry Kasparov.
It's a very difficult question to answer, because it's a personal issue. Yes, I want them to come back to Russia and to fight with us, because we need them. And I don't want to see my country losing the best minds the best young men and women that are trying to find good jobs elsewhere. But at the same time, it's their choice, and everybody is entitled to look for better living conditions. I know that I have to be with my people because at least I can rely on some sort of protection because I'm well known. If something happens to me, everybody talks about it. I can hire best lawyers. I can hire bodyguards. But there are thousands and thousands of Russians, mainly young Russians, across the country that are facing the same threats. They are intimidated by FSB, which is a successor of KGB, by other law enforcement officers, and the new law on extremism allows government to go after them on the pretext of them of making false statements about state officials.
So bottom line, it's a tough call. Michael, thanks for your call. Garry Kasparov, I want to turn, if I may, for just a moment to Moscow. We're joined from Moscow by NPR's Moscow correspondent, Gregory Pfeiffer. Gregory Pfeiffer, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
You've heard some of Garry Kasparov talking with us. Give us your sense of how this man, great chess player, very prominent globally, very prominent in Russia, how is he and how is his role today seen by different sectors of Russian society now?
Well, it's seen by some people in Russia, and I think by foreign correspondents, myself included, as central. I think Kasparov is essentially the top opposition leader, and I think this was symbolized by his arrest last month during an opposition protest when there was a serious police crackdown against peaceful demonstrators in Moscow and in St. Petersburg. It's the group that Kasparov leads is really at the forefront of battling the Kremlin.
They're is this the so-called the Other Russia or United Civil Front or?
Absolutely. Well, the Other Russia as a whole, mm-hmm. the United Civil Front is a part of that, mm-hmm. of course. They're the ones now that are who are holding these protests, who are really confronting the Kremlin, and they're saying that they are that they are open for other groups to join. That really, it's a coalition of disparate groups who are trying to do the most important thing right now, which is to form some kind of a united opposition to take on the Kremlin. Mm.
Garry Kasparov, one of the maybe the biggest democracy group in Russia. This, forgive my pronunciation, Yabloko. I'm reading
yeah.
here, and this is from
Apple. Yes, okay. It's Russian translation of Apple.
Great. Well, this is from Wikipedia, so I say that with full knowledge that it could be wrong. But it says here that they're boycotting the Other Russia, the group you're affiliated with, saying that it contains nationalist, fascists, and hard left groups and organizations, and they don't want any part of it. What's that about?
Again, I don't want to bother you with the names and titles of different organizations in Russia, but today, any political group, whether it's liberal or it's conservative nationalist, whether it's Yabloko and the Union of Right Forces on the liberal side mm-hmm. or the Communist Party or some nationalists on the opposite side, they are trying to win Kremlin's support for attacking the Other Russia. That's the best card you can use for getting your spot mm-hmm. into the Kremlin's conducted political theater in Russia. And you do not have to mix the statements from the heads of this organization, like Yavlinsky, he is the head of Yabloko, or Zhuganov, who is the head of the Communist Party, with the actions of their activists. For instance, St. Petersburg's Yabloko joined the Other Russia, and this mm-hmm. is the most active, most vibrant Yabloko organization in mm-hmm. Russia. The Moscow branch of the Communist Party is working with us. The Moscow branch of the Union of the Right Forces now is under threat of being dismantled by the federal authorities of this party because they are publicly supporting our actions. So we are not vying for support of these old corrupt leaders that used to work with Kremlin at any rate. Mm. We are trying to work with activists. We are trying to revive true political life in Russia, to come up with one united opposition, with the group that will be fighting Kremlin, not trying to cut a deal with Kremlin. Mm.
Gregory Pfeiffer, there in Moscow, how would you describe the particular coloring of Garry Kasparov's opposition to Putin and the Kremlin? You know, what face of the opposition do you see Garry Kasparov as representing?
Well, as I said, it's a disparate group. It's mostly quite liberal. But The central fact is that other Russia says that it doesn't have an ideology, that their main demand is for the holding of free and fair elections and to have a democratic process. There are various groups. The member groups are sort of westernized liberals and much more sort of radical groups that stage acts of civil disobedience. But the fact is that, as I said, this is the only group that's really taking on the Kremlin at the moment. Of course, the leaders of the other opposition groups, mainly the more social democratic Yabloko group and the Union of Right Forces, which is essentially a coalition of Yeltsin-era former so-called young reformers, these groups have really failed to unite and spend a lot of their time fighting among each other. And so the approach of Other Russia is different. It's unique. And I think a lot of people who are in the opposition and a lot of human rights activists really see this as the best hope to go forward.
And Grigory, just one last quick question. Well, he's been arrested already and detained for 11 hours. Does Garry Kasparov's international reputation, celebrity, protect him from being, you know, thrown in the slammer, locked up, really punished?
Not necessarily. I mean, the Kremlin has shown that it really doesn't care about Western opinion. And this is an important election year. There are parliamentary elections in December. Much more important are presidential elections next year when Putin will stand down after his two-term limit expires. Everything is about domestic politics in Russia right now, and the authorities really feel a sense of illegitimacy, and we saw that with the crackdown against the protesters last month. I don't think Mr. Kasparov's reputation will protect him. Certainly, it draws attention. He's using it to great effect to try to force some kind of confrontation with the Kremlin. But certainly, I don't think that that's going to protect him when push comes to shove. If the Kremlin really feels a threat, then yes, I think he's certainly under threat.
NPR Moscow correspondent Grigory Pfeiffer. Grigory, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Garry Kasparov, we've just got 20 seconds before the break, but you've said it's getting dangerous.
It is.
Would they move against you? Would they throw you in prison?
They can. I know that. But I have no choice but to lead our activists, because at least I have some protections, and thousands of other activists do not have same protection.
We're talking this hour with the world's longest reigning world chess champion turned now high profile Russian political dissident Garry Kasparov about life in chess and the hard politics of Russia today. Garry Kasparov has just flown in. He joins us from New York. Kishore is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Kishore. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Garry.
Hi.
It's an honor to speak with Mr. Kasparov. I don't have any questions. I only have two comments. One is, Mr. Kasparov, you're an extraordinarily talented guy, clearly an outstanding chess player, but now you're also showing that you're an extraordinarily brave man. And, you know, you mentioned Aristotle, the greatest philosopher ever. I hope that he guides you, and I hope that all in this country are cheering for you. Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you.
Thumbs up from Kishore in Buffalo in hopes that Aristotle watches over your shoulder.
Yes.
Kishore, thanks very much for calling.
I'm not sure that my opponents read Aristotle at all.
let's say he's still relevant. Let's go to Independence, Iowa, and George. George, you're on the air with Garry Kasparov.
Thank you. First, I have great respect for Mr. Kasparov. I followed your games against Deep Blue and Deeper Blue with great interest. And I would like to say that if any battle lines are being drawn in Russia, I would definitely pick the side that you are on as the eventual winner, I hope. My question's sort of been addressed, but I'm very curious at something that came up during the conversation, that Russia has indicated that it doesn't really care about the opinion of the West. And I was sort of wondering what Mr. Kasparov's thoughts were on that, and would pressure from the West be helpful or beneficial in the struggle? Thanks.
George, thanks. Garry Kasparov.
I disagree that Russian leadership doesn't care about the opinion of the West, because I have to repeat, all their money is kept in the Western countries. So they cannot ignore the strong opinion, if such opinion is presented by the Western leadership, but it was not.
But nobody's talking about cutting them off or freezing their bank accounts from their billions. I mean, that's not really, it's not like this is Iran or something. It's not even a threat here. So does it matter where the money is?
There was no single statement about situation in Russia from President Bush.
Mm.
For 7 years, he either has been praising Putin at the beginning of their relations, or now he's silent. The few statements from low-key officials from State Department that are not impressing Putin at all. Putin built up very good personal relations with the G7 club, with Bush, with Blair, with Schroeder, who is, by the way, now is working for Putin in the Gazprom. He's on his payroll.
Right.
Berlusconi, Vitaly Chirac.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yes, Schroeder is ex-chancellor of Germany. Mm-hmm. Berlusconi, prime minister of Italy, Chirac, now or the ex-president of France, and he enjoyed these personal relations, and there was no real criticism that he was afraid of.
But he's playing politically.
A few remarks from European Parliament members did make an effect.
But he's playing very, very prominently politically against the West recently, and George's question in part is, at this point in Russia's political life, does pressure from outside, from the West, for example, where you're sitting right now, does it help or hurt dissidents like you?
Yeah, but the pressure on Russia will be counterproductive. The pressure on certain people in Russia will be very effective. I'm sure, you know, United States government and their European counterparts, they know enough about bank accounts, not only of Russian oligarchs, but also about Russian officials. If they want to put pressure, they have to start dealing with these people. For instance, after the crackdown in Moscow and St. Petersburg in April, Russian human rights groups, they wrote a letter to the U.S. administration and to the European government, urging them not to give entry visas to mayor of Moscow, mayor of St. Petersburg,
right,
and to some top officials of Russian police that were responsible for these crackdowns. Do something. Because people in Russia, Putin and his friends, his cronies, they don't care about some empty statements from low-key officials. They recognize only action, and they didn't see any action from the West, and the West proved to be very vulnerable for their bullying tactics.
But you're a chess player. I mean, surely those Western banks are very happy to have those billions in their vaults. Russia's vote on the Security Council is important. People don't want to unnecessarily antagonize Russia. I mean, to me, it feels like we're light years away from the West, the United States, really putting that kind of visceral pressure on Russia.
Yeah, but I think in 1981, the Soviet Union was much more powerful than Russia today. But President Reagan, you know, spoke about evil empire, and he, you know, came up with the policies that not only antagonized the Soviet leadership, but also put them on check.
Today, the
West has much more influence over Russian officials because the money is kept here.
That's the external picture.
If they want to do something serious about it, they should stop talking and start acting.
And do it. There's the cry. Let me ask you about the internal politics here. You're very critical of Vladimir Putin, but I mean, I read here in the press, his approval ratings, this is the Western press, his approval ratings hover around 80%. He's got a nearly decade-long oil-driven economic boom that some portion of Russians like. There aren't many critical voices left in the media anymore. His tough-talking approach with the West appears to have won in popularity. If you're so right, why is he so popular?
I don't know about his popularity. I'm sure Saddam Hussein was popular. I'm sure Kim Jong Il is very popular. Lukashenko is popular. Mugabe is popular. You can't talk seriously about public polls in the country when the press is under strict control of the dictators.
Really? I'm quoting here. This isn't from a Russian publication. This is from Western publications. I'm sure they're taking their polls somewhere else.
They're quoting Russian opinion polls. And if you look at our demonstrations, they're relatively small, 5,000-6,000 people.
Yes,
but
they are.
The demographics is broad. You can have 6,000 people in Moscow, you know, from all social and age groups protesting if you have 80% support for the Putin's regime.
So when people say the Russians actually like the strongman and they like Putin because he's brought some kind of stability and he's been tough with the West, you're saying that's wrong?
It's very difficult to say yes or no because this question is mixed.
Mm-hmm.
Russians are still living under terrible psychological trauma of 1991 when we protested against the inefficient, corrupt regime, Soviet regime, dictatorial regime. But at the end of the day, the whole country collapsed.
Mm.
And also, there were a number of economic crisis in 19th under Yeltsin, especially this default, financial default in 1998. So people are still viewing all these years of reforms as quite a tragic time of instability. And obviously they don't want to do anything that may jeopardize this illusion of stability as they perceive it today. But at the same time, I don't believe that there is any silent majority that is ready to defend Putin. The problem is how to raise enough people to join the active protest.
Garry Kasparov is with us, the winningest world chess champ ever, held that title longer than anybody else ever has. Now he's very prominent in the dissident democracy movement in Russia. Garry Kasparov, let's take a bunch of calls. Lots of people want to speak with you. David's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Garry. Garry,
hey, David.
As we all know, you're half Jewish and half Armenian. And as is well known, and this is in the particularly in the Los Angeles Times in the last few days, Jewish groups in Washington, D.C. are unfortunately supporting Turkey in opposing the Armenian genocide resolution in Congress. Of course, they always themselves push Holocaust remembrance, as is proper. But my question is, how do you feel as someone who is part Armenian that Jewish groups in Washington, such as the ADL, want to stifle Armenian genocide recognition?
My father was Jewish, my mother was Armenian, but as you know, many people born in this country, you know, with different ethnic origin, I consider myself Russian. But of course, I'm following Israeli politics or Armenian politics, and the question that you raised is very sensitive. I personally have no doubt that Turkey will have eventually have to recognize the genocide if this country wants to join the European Union. And I don't think there is any other choice for Turkey to move ahead without recognizing this horrible massacre of 1915. And if there are activities, as you described now, of Jewish groups supporting Turkey in their attempts to stifle the recognition of the genocide, that's obviously another policy of double standards. And that's what I reject most of all, because you can't promote democracy in Iraq and ignore the crackdown on democracy in Russia. You can't talk about Holocaust and deny the Armenian genocide in Turkey.
David, thanks for your call. Peter's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air with Garry Kasparov.
Yes, hi, guys. My question is about war in Iraq again. And it seems to me American don't have any idea what to do with troops, and I'm very worried about this. And I'd like to ask him what he thinks about, should Americans stay or should Americans leave Iraq? Thank you.
The chess master is asked to comment on U.S. policy in Iraq. How about it?
I think that if such important and risky decision is taken as to topple Saddam Hussein, to occupy Iraq, it had to be followed by some precise measures. Obviously, if your troops are there, then you should look at Iran, you should look at Syria. All pressure should be exercised to force these terrorist regimes to drop support of Hezbollah and Hamas. But what we saw that American troops being strangled between Syria, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, three major sponsors of terrorism, and at the same time, nothing was done to prevent further support given by these countries to Hamas, Hezbollah, and other terrorist groups. So it was a failure, and I don't want to start analyzing the performance in 2003 or 2004 or the origins of this invasion. But right now, I think it's the best thing America can do is just to recognize that it was a failure and to start, you know, regrouping for continuation of this war on terror, recognizing that what's happened in Iraq was a disaster. At the end of the day, if the idea was to liberate Iraq from Saddam Hussein, as someone who was born in the communist country, I cannot ignore the validity of such a goal. And to restore democracy, fine, it's done. At the end of the day, civil war is also a form of democratic expression. It's a very brutal way, but they can do whatever they want with their own lives. Staying there, in my view, is just only makes situation worse, because there is no game plan that can support Americans being in the center of this crisis.
Straight from the chess master's shoulder there, Kathy is calling from Bethany, Connecticut. Hi, Kathy, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask a question about the average Russian citizen. I had the occasion to know for a very long time a couple that emigrated from Russia, and they're an elderly couple now. I've known them for maybe 15 years. The woman in this couple said to me, democracy will never come to Russia because the average Russian person does not understand what democracy is, cannot conceive of living the way we do in a democracy. It's just so foreign to them. What is your take on that?
Gary?
Thanks, Kathy. It's a very important question, and obviously Russians never experienced a true democracy as you here in this country or others in, say, Western Europe. But you have to start somewhere. And while traveling across Russia, and for the last 2 years I traveled from Vladivostok to Kaliningrad, visiting more than 30 different regions of Russia, and I had a chance of speaking to Russians from different quarters, different social or age groups, I could see that they are slowly getting the main concept of democracy. They recognize that high living standards somehow are related or depend on the political freedom. It's highly unusual for Russians, but let's not forget that South Koreans or Japanese also didn't have any concept of democracy 60 years ago. And I think that many Russians today, thanks to Putin, probably that's the only good thing about his rule. Mm. He taught Russians from different political factions, both political activists and ordinary citizens, that only liberal democracy, free and fair elections, could serve as the foundation of the modern successful state. And Russians are asking the same question in different forms. Why, when the country is getting so rich, with this tons of money floating in, you know, because of the high energy prices, mm-hmm. we are not seeing any benefits? Why there is less money in our pockets? And they suspect that this disparity is a result of their inability to influence Russian bureaucracy. This is something to do with Putin's abolishment of the elections of the governors and mm-hmm. other officials. It doesn't mean that they already recognize that elections is the only way to go forward, but this suspicion is already a very important step forward. And I think that very soon the concept of the free and fair elections will dominate in their minds, because it's definitely better than the situation they're experiencing today.
You wrote on a hopeful note in the aftermath of Boris Yeltsin's death in an essay in the Wall Street Journal. You wrote, daylight is starting to show through the cracks of the KGB facade as the system runs out of resources to plunder. Soon it will again be time for building and rebuilding in Russia. Gary Kasparov, what would that look like? If it should come, what would this building and rebuilding look like?
You know, we mentioned Aristotle capital a couple of times, and I believe that there is some sort of historical determination. Yeltsin's regime and Putin's regime, which in my view is a completion of a regime seeded by Yeltsin, was based on the ability or on a chance given to old Soviet bureaucracy and some, you know, young entrepreneurs, so-called young reformers, to build up a system which was using the Soviet heritage, so the resources allocated by the Soviet regime. And today, there is nothing more to distribute. This era is over. It may take a year or two, but at the end of the day, for Russia to survive, we have to start building. And this regime is not capable of building something. It can only distribute. It can only take something and bring it away. But for us, you know, to have future, for us to have some sort of a perspective, we have to create a regime which will be concentrating on creating national wealth, not looting the country.
We've got half a minute. For an intellect like you, like yours, what's more engaging, the chessboard or this realm of politics?
Chess had rules, and I felt very comfortable. Now I'm in danger, I understand it. But I also feel comfortable because I live in comfort with myself. I know that I'm doing something very, very important, and I'm very proud that I'm with my country, with my people at such a historic moment.
Gary Kasparov, world chess champion from 1985 to 2000, now heads the opposition group United Civil Front and is part of the opposition umbrella group, The Other Russia. Gary Kasparov, thank you very much for being with us today. We really appreciate your time and insights.
Thank you very much,
Tom. Thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.